WMRA News, I'm Dan Easley. A new resource to help families fight being evicted from their homes, continued protests on campuses across the Commonwealth, and a conversation with an award-winning Harrisonburg novelist. This is the WMRA Daily for Thursday, May 2nd. The chair of the Stanton School Board has resigned. The news leader reports that Natasha McCurdy and her twin sister are under investigation. No criminal charges have been filed, but the investigation is alleging embezzlement, grand larceny, and obtaining money by false pretenses. McCurdy's sister is treasurer of the A.R. Ware Elementary School's Parent Teacher Association, and the two sisters own Queen City Games and Gifts. Voting for the June primary starts this week. From Virginia Public Radio, Michael Pope reports.
Friday is the first day of voting for the June primary because Virginia has 45 days of early voting. That's the longest in the country. University of Virginia political analyst J. Miles Coleman says numbers from last year's primary show Democrats are more likely than Republicans to vote early. But he says Republicans are also showing up early.
If you look at some of the competitive Republican primaries last year, you know, the early vote is consistently 20-30% of the overall vote. So not as much as Democrats, but it's still not nothing. You know, that's still a valuable piece of electoral real estate.
Jennifer Victor is a political science professor at George Mason University, and she says research shows having a long period of early voting might actually end up decreasing turnout.
Election day is an event that we can all focus on, and it becomes like a community thing. And when you have a long early voting period, it kind of decreases the climax of election day in a way that can have a negative impact on turnout, unless you've also coupled your voter reforms with things like same-day voting.
Now, Virginia now has same-day voter registration. But Victor says Virginia's ID laws are more restrictive than other places. As a result, she says the jury is still out on whether Virginia's 45 days of early voting increases turnout or perhaps even decreases it. Michael Pope.
Tens of thousands of homes lost power in Northern Virginia and the Northern Neck yesterday. Dominion Energy and Northern Neck Electric Cooperative customers reported outages just after 2 p.m. A spokesperson for Dominion says construction equipment caught fire near their transmission system, causing the outages. The fire has been extinguished. Power restoration began immediately. Dominion expects work to be done this afternoon or evening. Danish manufacturer Topsoe plans to open a solid oxide electrolyzer cell plant in Chesterfield County, adding about 150 new jobs. SOECs use electricity to convert water into hydrogen, which can be used to store renewable energy. According to Governor Glenn Youngkin and Democratic members of Virginia's congressional delegation, Topsoe will spend $400 million on the project and receive over $100 million in tax credits from the Federal Inflation Reduction Act. Virginia has some of the top evicting cities in the nation. Now a legal group has set up a website to help families fight when they can't get a lawyer. WHRO's Ryan Murphy has more.
Phil Story is a housing attorney with the Virginia Poverty Law Center. He says more than 100,000 families face eviction every year in Virginia, far too many for legal aid attorneys to help or even for the attorney-staffed eviction hotline the center ran from 2019 until last year. Using lessons learned from that hotline, the group has started the Eviction Defense Center, publishing resources online for families facing eviction without a lawyer.
Hopefully, folks who shouldn't be getting evicted or folks who have a good defense can actually raise that defense and avoid eviction in court.
FightMyEviction.org, which is also available in Spanish, includes step-by-step explanations of the eviction process and scripts for court appearances. Data from Princeton University's Eviction Lab shows several Hampton Roads cities continue to have some of the highest eviction rates in the nation.
That was Ryan Murphy with partner WHRO News. Students all across the country are staging protests regarding Israel's attack on Gaza. Virginia Tech, Virginia Commonwealth University, and the University of Mary Washington responded by arresting more than 100 people and charging them with trespassing. The University of Virginia has taken a different tack, as Virginia Public Radio's Standy Hossman reports.
Free, free, free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
Free, free, free Palestine!
About 100 students gathered beside the historic rotunda at UVA and on the lawn with signs protesting Israeli attacks in Gaza. Campus police said they could stay as long as they did not take up residence. And this student, who declined to give her name, says they complied.
Tents were prohibited and the university strongly discouraged sleeping. So the majority of people stayed up all night.
They sang, they chanted, they ate pizza and gave speeches. Their signs called for an end to fighting and disclosure by the university of any investments in Israel or companies that make weapons. Faculty members Robert Fatan, Susan Freeman, and Olu Domini Agnaike were also on hand.
What is going on in Gaza is so atrocious. You're talking about 35,000 people killed, two-thirds of them women and kids.
As faculty, we're especially dismayed by the flattening of all of the universities in Gaza and the murder of many of the faculty and students.
UVA is supposed to be a university that's great and good, and this kind of free discussion and dialogue about important ideas is a part of the university mission.
They expressed a hope that the university would comply with student demands and allow peaceful protests to continue. In Charlottesville, I'm Sandy Houseman.
Students at James Madison University have joined protests against the war in Gaza. WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports.
About 50 students were gathered on the JMU quad at noon on Wednesday. They painted signs and read a list of demands, calling for transparency about JMU's financial investments.
Divestment from all Israeli companies.
And weapons manufacturers.
And weapons manufacturers.
In light of the military aid the U.S. provides to Israel, students also took issue with the university's research and scholarship partnerships with the U.S. Department of Defense and companies such as Northrop Grumman. Kin, a junior who declined to give their last name, said the protesters also demand
amnesty for students engaging in political protests on campus and the release of a statement condemning the Israeli genocide in Gaza.
Recent protest encampments at other colleges, such as UCLA, Columbia, and Virginia Tech, have ended in clashes with counter-protesters and arrests. The JMU students intend to gather each day and not camp out overnight.
JMU said no tents, and they said no megaphones, and we are abiding by JMU's rules because we want this to be safe for everyone involved.
In response to a request for comment, JMU sent us a statement which read in part, quote, "As a public institution, we support the freedom of expression and civil discourse within the boundaries of the Constitution and consistent with university policies and the Code of Virginia," end quote. The Wall Street Journal reported earlier this week that more than 34,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's ongoing retaliation for the October 7th Hamas attacks. But the collapse of civilian infrastructure has left Gaza's health authorities unable to count all the dead. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
And in disclosure, James Madison University holds the operating license for WMRA, and various departments at the school underwrite programs on the station. Award-winning Harrisonburg novelist Rebecca Kaufman tells her stories through the eyes of ordinary people. After four successful novels, Rebecca's newest book, I'll Come to You, will be released in January. WMRA's Chris Boros asked Rebecca about her passion for stories.
I've always loved story, and that was sort of early childhood, being read to, reading myself eventually, and then writing little books was a passion of mine, and then sort of just gravitated away from that in middle school, high school. Violin took over as primary interest, and then did go to a music conservatory, which was an intensely competitive environment. However, the sort of solitary nature of practice room at the conservatory would prepare me for the writing life. So I graduated with my degree in violin performance, but then worked in public relations in New York City, where I was already living for several years. And recession hit, so about 2008, 2009, I found myself somewhat professionally adrift and was sort of re-inspired to enter the writing life and wrote a bit and used some of those early stories to apply for MFA programs and was accepted at NYU, which is where I wrote a few stories that later became my first book.
And then you got your degree then in creative writing. Right.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I got my MFA in creative writing fiction.
Were you querying literary agents or how did that work for you?
I was. So I left New York and moved down to Harrisonburg with the intention of finishing a book and living in a small town where I could live inexpensively, prioritize writing. I worked a restaurant job. So I was working in the evenings and writing in the mornings, which was my hope. When the time came then to start thinking about an agent after I'd finished my novel down here after a year or two down here. I just did it the old-fashioned way, sent out query letters.
And it worked.
It worked.
It's almost sounds like a success story, if you ask me. Do you feel that way sometimes? Like, I mean, you've written now, you got a fifth one coming out next year, right?
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, thank you. It is a thrill to do what truly, deeply, profoundly brings me joy.
Yeah.
And to do it, you know, I've put a book out every other year-ish now since 2016, and it's incredible. It's what I love. Yeah, to sort of return to the idea of storytelling. I've just always had this deep, abiding interest in other people's lives, the way that other people exist and think. And writing has just become my way of sort of scratching that itching curiosity that I've always had.
You grew up in rural Ohio,
mm-hmm.
and now you're in Harrisonburg.
Mm-hmm.
What brought
mm-hmm.
you here?
So my sister was a student at EMU, and she's several years older than me. And after I graduated with my MFA, I wasn't quite sure what my next move would be, but I moved down here to be close to her. And I didn't expect to stay here. I thought I would just work a restaurant job, try and write a book, try and finish a book. But I fell in love with Harrisonburg, met my husband, have children now. And yeah, this is definitely home.
Your next book comes out in January. It's called Yes. I'll Come to You.
Yes.
What's it about?
So I'll Come to You is a novel about family. It spans 1 year, 1995, in the life of one family. It's anchored by the anticipation and then arrival of a child. January opens with news of the pregnancy, and then it moves through the baby's first Christmas. Chapters are told from alternating perspectives. So you have chapters from the expectant parents, from the expectant grandparents, and various others. So it's really about the reverberations of new life and, you know, the way that new life might transform, animate, intensify the life in its proximity.
When you're writing a story like that, how much of that is based on a family you know or your own personal family, or is it 100% fiction?
It's all fictionalized. No one that I know would, I don't think, see them recognize themselves in a character of something that I've written. But undeniably, one draws from their own life. So yeah, the emotional landscape is true to my experience, but the people and scenarios themselves are not.
If you could recommend one book for someone to read, like a book that changed your life.
Man, what I'm reading right now is incredible. It's a novella. It's very short. It's called Last Night at the Lobster by Stuart Onan. It's about the final shift at a Red Lobster, which is going to be closed down. And it's just beautiful.
Harrisonburg novelist Rebecca Kaufman, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been great.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
To hear a longer version of this conversation and to find a pre-order link for her next book, visit WMRA.org. This interview was produced and edited by WMRA student employee Lily Arsenault. For WMRA News, I'm Dan Easley. Thanks for listening.